Thanks for joining us. My name is Ibrahim Sani. We're doing a very special program called Economies of Elections, a sub-program of my own show, Notepad, in the studio. Joining me for this extremely interesting program, it's called Live, by the way, is the Professor of Asian Studies at University of Tasmania, Professor James Chin. James, thanks again for taking the time to speak with us all the way here in Bukit Jalil. And of course, you hiked not just from Tasmania. You did go around the country to visit some of the places, including speaking to some of the people, from politicians to people alike. Maybe you can share with us, what is your impression so far of the campaign and perhaps some keynotes that you can share with us when it comes to this election?
Sure. So I think this election is special for several reasons. The first one is that people keep forget that, you know, for the last 40 general elections, there was always one dominant party. So this is the first time in Malaysia's election history where there was no clear dominant party entering the elections. Secondly is, of course, the economic dimension. This is the first general elections where we're coming out of the pandemic. People keep forgetting that the last 2 years has been very, very difficult for what we call the B40 segment of the population. So they're still recovering for it. So in some ways, when they elect a new government, they're electing a government that will take Malaysia, in economic terms, back to normality. The third point about this election is, of course, this is a unique election in that all the previous elections, nobody talks about political stability. It was just a continuation. This time, all the key players are talking about stability, or they're all promising stability. And of course, the other really important thing about this election compared to all the previous elections is that this is the first time where we're getting automatic registration. So we're looking at supposedly about 7 million new voters. Now, that's a large block. Out of about 22 million, so one third of them are basically first-time voters. So this is a very, very different election from all the previous elections. In other words, everything you know about all the previous elections go out the window.
Okay, let's talk about that then. You've mentioned four key points. I want to touch on point number one and point number three, which is, of course, everybody's promising stability. And, of course, there's no dominant party trying to get the heads up in this. Depending on who you speak to or who you speak with, they argue that one party is above the rest. Where do you see the truth in these kind of statements?
Right. So far, in terms of surveys or polling done, there has been six major surveys I'm aware of talking about political attitudes of the people here in Malaysia. All the six surveys, different designs, but basically they're trying to gauge the political angle in terms of coming general election. So out of these six surveys, four says that the Barisan Nasional will come back to power, and the other two says that Pakatan Harapan will come back to power. But I have to caution everyone because surveys and pollings don't decide the elections. And also, one of the problems we have in Malaysia is that a lot of people in Malaysia are actually not last-minute voters. They'll decide in the last 2 or 3 days. So the polling doesn't capture that. Secondly, polling is limited in terms of capturing how people vote, because a lot of the questions the survey asks doesn't deal with emotions. So, for example, in the rural areas, right, we know that a lot of people vote, especially in the Malay Kampong, right, because of emotional ties to other members of the family, right? So, for example, maybe you want to vote in a certain way, maybe you want to vote for the opposition, but because your whole family votes for the ruling party, there's a lot of emotional pressure on you to vote in a similar way. So polling does not capture any of those things. And thirdly, it's also very important to note that polling doesn't capture the fact that in the Malaysian system, we're using first-past-the-post. So it doesn't matter in terms of percentage, right? All you have to do is that you have more votes than all the other jokers, you know, standing in your constituency.
There's also that whole idea of whether or not they can actually offer that kind of stability. A lot of talk has been said in terms of if one particular coalition wins, let's say 70 or 80 seats, it's a lot easier for that particular coalition to strike up some form of coalition partnership with some other partners, thus providing that kind of so-called stability. That's not true based on what we saw in January 14. Harapan won a bunch of seats, eventually disintegrated by itself. Where do you see the stability element comes in?
Right. So basically, the way to understand the Malaysian electoral system is that forget about the 222 seats you have in parliament. Basically, there's only two blocks in the Malaysian parliament. One is what we call the rural Malay seats that account for 80 to 90 seats. That is the block that Pakatan, GTA, Barisan, all of them are chasing. The other block is, of course, Sabah and Sarawak, 57 seats. So basically, on the peninsula side, you got to win the Malay block and you want to build some sort of alliance with the party in Sabah and Sarawak. Now, Sabah and Sarawak is important Because what happened with Sabah and Sarawak is that everybody expect GPS in Sarawak to win, you know, 25 to 27 seats. So out of 57, they basically control half, one big block. Now, 25 may sound very little to you, but that's actually 10% of the seats in Parliament. So whoever decide can't get a clear majority on the peninsula side, right? The first port of call they have to call is probably GPS to try to build some sort of alliance. The other important point to note, and this is not widely reported on this side, is that people don't understand the sentiments in Sabah and Sarawak. I can tell you the sentiments in Sabah and Sarawak are completely different. You talk about political stability. I can tell you a lot of people in Sabah and Sarawak do not buy the argument. Why? They want the federal government to be weak, so you rely on Sabah and Sarawak to stay in power, right? Which means they can get maximum concessions. They want more autonomy. They want more money. They can't get that if there's a very strong government on this side.
Oh, wow.
So it's quite ironical, right? So on this side, people are looking for political stability.
No, ironic, it makes sense.
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
Yes.
Let's talk about this. Let's qualify first. You're a Sarawakian yourself. You've been doing this for quite some time when it comes to Sarawak politics. You've also came back from Sabah. You know the kind of muted campaign that is currently happening in Sabah when it comes to the viewership and the noise that has been created out of Sabah campaign here in Peninsula. There's a lot of audiences that is in Sabah who can agree with us that the kind of conversations that is happening in Sabah might not necessarily reverberate across the nationwide conversations that we see in our mainstream media. Why is that so? What would be the real situation on the ground? And how do we tie this up with that whole notion of this whole idea of Sabah and Sarawak might not necessarily want stability coming in from Malaysian politics in Semenanjung?
Right. So the way to understand Sabah and Sarawak is that Sarawak is basically locking. So GPS is sort of dominating the entire process. So I expect GPS to steamroll the Sarawak elections. There are 31 seats. So at the current moment, of course, campaign makes a difference. There's still, you know, a week left. But at the present moment, if nothing changes in Sarawak, I expect GPS to pick up between 25 to 27 seats. So almost 90% of the seats. In Sabah, it's basically a three-way fight. It's between GRS, which is the local version of GPS. There's Warisan, who's trying to create a new third bloc in Malaysian politics. And the other bloc is, of course, Pakatan. So in terms of Sabah, right, in terms of the seat distribution, unless something very big happens, I expect Pakatan, they will actually maybe get two or three. The big blocks will be Warisan, GRS, plus Barisan. Barisan, I suspect, will do quite well because UMNO Sabah is quite strong. So basically, the way it works is that whoever forms the federal government can be assured of about 35 to 40 seats from the East Malaysian side. So that's a huge block. So the real question for Peninsula Malaysia is that, is there a dominant coalition on this side out of the big three, Pakatan, Perikatan and Barisan Nasional? Can any of these three reach the magic figure, which is about 100? Because when you talk about political stability in Malaysia, right, basically you're talking about at least 120 above so that people can't do funny things. Super political stability here is really 148 or the two-thirds majority.
Yeah, but that was like Mahathir's time lah, at least Badawi 2003.
Sure. So, but my point is that, you know, can anybody on this side reach 100 so that plus the 30 or 40 from Sabah and Sarawak, they'll get a good, stable government for the next 5 years. And getting a stable government...
Sorry, let's ask that question back to you. Have you seen any indication that any of them might get up to 100?
So my impression is that in the last few days, everything is very quiet here. I am surprised how quiet, you know, if you travel around Kuala Lumpur and the major urban areas, right, it's as if there is no elections. Very limited flats, people are going their own way. So there's two ways of reading this. One is that the urban people couldn't care less about the election. Secondly, the bulk of the people in the urban areas have decided which way to vote already. But the problem is, this is a false sense of security because the urban people do not elect the next government. The people who elect the next government is the rural Malay vote. And there's a lot of competition in the rural areas. So my take is that UMNO, by and large, the machinery is intact. Perikatan machinery may or may not be there. And if there's a good machinery in Perikatan, it's mostly PAS machinery, right? And the third block is Pakatan. Pakatan is ramming up the machinery in rural areas. So we have to see what's happening in rural areas. The other interesting thing happening in the rural areas that I would argue, and where I'm very different from all the surveys done, is that I don't believe that the Malay vote will split in the rural areas this time. I would argue that you go back to pre-2018, one dominant Malay party plus a smaller party. so there won't be split anymore, and that we will get political stability at the end of this process.
Okay, before we go into the break, final question on that whole first port of call for many of the Peninsular Malaysia political party is to go to GPS. GPS has had a history of backing Barisan Nasional. Will this be the case right now, on, say, November 11, or, sorry, 19?
Sure. So basically, the politicians in Sabah, Sarawak don't owe any loyalty to any of the coalitions of parties in Peninsular Malaysia. So what everyone will do is basically they will look at the numbers on Saturday night when the results come out. Now, you know, right, the formal results will probably come out, and you know, by the time they get the majority, it will probably be 11 or midnight. But people forget that the political parties actually have a lot of people on individual booths, so they get the report a lot faster. I suspect by around 9 o'clock, they already know who's going to win. So there'll be a lot of flurry of phone calls between all these people. I don't expect GPS to turn down anybody who approached them, but they will definitely go with the group with the largest number. I'm quite sure they are most comfortable working with the Barisan Nasional, but if Barisan Nasional doesn't have the largest number, they're quite happy to work with the other groups. A lot will depend on the conditions that you attach. In other words, what will Sarawak get in return for the support?
Let's talk about that. I thought MA63 was part of it, Sarawak Oil Royalty was part of it. Anything else that is in consideration?
Well, for example, in Sabah and Sarawak, they're talking about individual ministries now. They want individual ministries now. What I can tell you is that whoever wins government, it is almost certain that there will be a deputy prime minister from Sabah and Sarawak, because they've already promised that.
Many of them have promised up to three even, so, you know.
So we will get a minimum of one. So the trick is, what sort of ministers will you be getting? Because, you know, we know that certain ministries are extremely powerful. So the question is that, you know, what sort of ministries will be given to Sarawak? What sort of ministries will be given to Sabah? But I think the oil and gas issue, although it's very, very strong on the ground in Sabah and Sarawak, that issue cannot be resolved, not now and not in the future.
Then this would be the most contentious point, don't you think, in terms of what Sarawak is going to push for?
Yes, but the thing is that there are several ways around the issue, but basically you cannot remove the federal government control over the oil and gas resources in Petronas, for the simple reason that the Malaysian budget, the development part, basically the money comes from Petronas. If you give this money back to Sabah and Sarawak, right, Petronas got no money to give to the development part of the federal budget.
Okay, all right. We'll go for one short break. When we come back, we'll discuss a little bit more with James Chin of University of Tasmania. We'll be right back after these messages. Thanks for staying on with us. I have with me the Professor of Asian Studies at the University of Tasmania, Professor James Chin. James is, of course, in the studio joining me. James, let's talk about November 19th. There's a lot that needs to be unpacked there. A lot of people are saying, OK, November 19th, as you alluded to just now, 11 o'clock, we're going to have a new prime minister, or at least, a prime minister. But there are a lot of us that are thinking about the whole coalition building that requires a lot of time. Horse trading is the word that I've been hearing a few times now for the past few days since the campaign has begun, to a point where one has even stipulated that, you know, it might take up to 7 days, and, you know, going up and down of the palace, talking to the king even. What's the reality of things when it comes to the on-the-ground situation? Where do you think it's going to be? Will we have something of a government of sorts on the 19th of November that evening, or will the whole conversation take place over the next few days?
Sure. So it is my take that there will be a dominant Malay party emerging in Peninsular Malaysia, and that dominant party will reach out to Sabah and Sarawak. They will cobble a coalition very quickly. So I expect the Prime Minister to be sworn in either on the 19th at night or early morning on the 20th. So we will definitely get the Prime Minister. As you know, the Constitution only mentions the Prime Minister. The actual Cabinet, all those things, that will be distributed later. So we will not have any political instability. I'm very, very sure of that. So I don't think Malaysia needs to worry about political instability. What Malaysia really needs to worry about more is that what is the next government going to do about all the economic headwinds we're facing, and we're facing very, very serious economic headwinds. So we have to be very careful about the government we elect. Thus far, we've got all the coalitions, you know, in terms of the manifesto and promises, they're talking about throwing free money. That is fine. But the problem is that if you throw money in the non-productive sectors, it means at the end of next year, we will be having a lot of economic problems. And this economic headwind is not going to go away. Part of it is something that can't be avoided. I think we all know the Ukraine war has upped international trade and caused a lot of problems, and that will stay over for some time to come. So we really need not only political stability, we need competent economic managers. And if you talk to the market, right, a lot of people are saying that some of the candidates being named as the next finance minister may not be up to the job.
Okay, let's talk about this. I don't want to talk about politics, personalities of who might be the next finance minister. It's too early. We haven't even had the polling day yet. But the three big ideas that we need to talk about is, number one is, of course, inflation. Number two is, of course, falling ringgit. Number three is, of course, this interest of foreign investors coming to the country. This is on the back of rising inflation, in rising interest rates, not just in Malaysia, but around the world. We're also talking about that whole idea of how youth unemployment is hitting record highs now. And most importantly, just general economic headwinds that might not necessarily see answers coming in from any of these campaigners. GST, narrow tax base, the whole idea of the inability for us to talk about weaning off our subsidies. 80 billion has been talked about for the longest of time. I disagree. I think it's more now. Nobody's talking about the bigger number that is, or the reality of the numbers here. It might even reach 100 billion. No answers from the candidates. How I know? I do follow each and every single one of these coalitions and the candidates. And other than Rafizi talking about how he has rationalized his wealth through his asset declaration, nobody else is talking about this. Am I going out of my mind, or am I not listening to the right places here?
I think you're not going out of the mind. I think the reason why they do not want to talk about it is because it's election time, because they don't have answers. The bottom line is that there's no way to control inflation for most of next year, because a lot of that inflation is imported inflation into Malaysia. They can't do anything. What I'm talking about is institutional reforms in the economy. So, for example, there is something that the Malaysian government can do about the economy, because we don't have a normal economy. The reality is that our economy, you can move the entire economy because the GLCs control the economy. So it's a question of whether the government wants to undertake real reforms. Now, my argument is that that is probably the best time to undertake real reforms, because we are facing economic headwinds. You do not do reforms when times are good. You do reforms when times are bad, because that is when, you really need to undertake reforms. Now, the question is, will the next government have the political will? Because one of the unusual things about Malaysia is that every time we have an economic crisis, a political crisis, instead of trying to solve and make fundamental institutional changes to the economy, right, the politicians always buy or pay their way out. So we really need to change our way of thinking about how to fix the economy.
If they don't have answers, well, clearly they don't. It's not an if. They don't have the answers. How are we going to decide on polling day which party or personality to choose?
The short answer is that Malaysians vote, majority of Malaysians vote based on irrational factors. A lot of them vote according to emotions. But this time is different. This time, there's a big block of undi 18, first-time voters.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that. Let's deep dive on that. So you did allude to the fact that this is point number four out of the four ideas that you wanted to share early on in the interview. One of them is the fourth idea is, of course, undi 18, forming about 7 million out of the 21 million voters. These are very, very problematic in the sense that we do not know or cannot anticipate the way they vote. Never assume, say, for instance, the youth want to vote for one particular coalition. So because of this, the wildcard factor must be so crazy or insanely hard for us to predict what is next to be done. Where do you see the voting trends and voting patterns will be? How important would it be in some areas where seats can go as high as 40% or even 30%? Many of them are 30%, the numbers I saw from the Edge Weekly this week publication. I don't know whether you saw it. They listed down the kind of Undi 18 and the percentages of new voters within that particular areas or constituencies. It's so wild card. It's unbelievable for us to even guess or speculate where the situation is going to be. How do you view this?
Okay, big picture, if there is a mass number of young people coming out, in other words, 70-80% of them come out, right, then Pakatan will win.
But aren't they concentrated in some areas like urban and all this?
No. If there's a huge turnout, Pakatang will benefit. Now, in terms of the impact, you vote usually impact less in the urban area compared to the rural areas because the urban areas, the seats are a lot bigger. The problem is this. I don't believe the youth will come out in big numbers. I suspect the youth turnout rate will be lower than the whatever the rate is for the wider population. So, for example, if the turnout rate is 70%, the youth will be about 55%.
Yeah, got it.
The problem now is that majority of youth now have not made up their mind. Now, you and I both know, right? They can't wake up on Saturday morning and decide to go to vote because they need to go to check the SPR website and find out where their voting booth is, plus what time they're supposed to go and vote. They can't do it at the last minute. But the problem with youth in Malaysia is that most of them either have given up on politics or they think that I can wait until the very last minute.
I disagree with you. I've met enough youth that might be interested in voting for this election, but perhaps that is not representative of that 7 million that we speak of. How do you come to that conclusion?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember I talked about that there were about 6 surveys done. A lot of these surveys, they go in specialist, especially go and target the 18, 19, 20-year-old. Most of them said that they haven't made up their mind. In other words, they will probably wait until the very last minute. Now, the problem is, are the political parties reaching out to them? My answer is yes. Because one of the big difference between now and 2018 was that you suddenly see there's a flood of TikTok videos, strict political videos coming out, and they're all targeting at the youth groups. Now, the problem is that, will the TikTok videos make the youth think, you know, between now and Thursday, log on the SPR website, find out where they're going to vote, and make arrangements to go back on Saturday or wherever it is to vote? I don't know, because, like you said, we don't have data. The only data we have is sort of the Johor state election, and that data is incomplete. Now, the other thing about the youth vote is that the youth vote is distributed, as you mentioned, unevenly, but they make a big impact in certain Malay areas. So the question is that, are the youth willing? Because we know a lot of the youth don't live in where the IC address is. So the question is that, are they going to plan, you know, take Friday off or Saturday off from Kuala Lumpur to Mid-Klang Valley and go back to the place they vote? All these are big questions that can't be answered until end of next week, because that is when we will see, if the youth are really hyped out, we will see evidence of that in the social media. Right now, all the TikTok videos are basically produced by the political parties or politicians. We haven't seen a lot of, you know, reaction to all these things from the actual youth themselves. So it's a big question mark. I don't know. I'm also hoping to see a big turnout, but I'm afraid that it'll be lower than the general turnout.
Okay, and because of this, why do you think that, say, for instance, Harapan is not focusing so much on youth and trying to get them out to vote? Is that...
Oh, they are. Like I said, there's been a flood of TikTok videos. But the problem is that we don't know what is the impact, whether they're actually reaching the intended target and whether there's a reaction. We haven't seen that yet.
Okay, finally, let's talk about the hot seats. Sungai Buloh, Kuala Selangor, you name it, right? Some seats, including Gombak and Ampang. Where do you see these kind of conversations going to take place in terms of, you know, how the voters are going to select? I'm a Sungai Buloh voter. I don't know who's going to win.
Yeah, but I think Sungai Buloh, all these so-called seats is because of the personalities involved. So I think Sungai Buloh is interesting because Khairee or KJ is very lucky because his opponents have problems. So if he wins, I would argue, if he wins big, I would argue that it's because on the other side, they had a very weak opponent, right? In terms of Gombak, I've been sort of watching that. I think it's all very quiet now. If you would ask me to bet, I will bet on the incumbent Menteri Besar to beat the former Menteri Besar. I think there is a group of people in Gombak who are very, very angry and they carry on their anger. Because normally we Malaysians are very, what they call, easygoing people. We forgive easily. That's the reason why we have this famous saying, give chance, give chance. You know, but in the case of Gombak, for whatever reason, there's a big block of voters who sort of can't forgive somebody for the Sheraton move. Mm-hmm. So you know, if that group, you know, sustain their anger until November 19, I think our friend is in big trouble.
Okay, what about Ampang?
I haven't kept an eye on Ampang at all.
Okay, finally, the Kuala Selangor seat. I think that's very interesting as well.
Yes, Kuala Selangor is interesting. Because, you know, you got two interesting characters there. Again, I don't know because I haven't gone down and I think it's wrong for me to try to say something about places I haven't been to.
Okay. Finally, let's talk a little bit more about the whole general idea of how you think the voter turnout is going to be. Honestly, deep down, you have the answer in terms of where you have various data points. where do you see this election is going to turn out in terms of a voter turnout and excitement? Will it go, you know, will the intensity increase over time? Or is it going to be like this? Because, like, in a way, it's kind of muted. I mean, there's a lot of noise. You and I on Twitter all the time, a lot of noise. Not so much that kind of bravado that we saw in 2018.
Yes. Well, in 2018, right, there was a real feeling that you can change a government. I think that feeling has completely disappeared. So my take is that this week is the final week and this is the crucial week. Now, the problem is that can the political party mobilise? My understanding is that the political parties are becoming very conscious about the seats they're going after. So, for example, I can tell you that in terms of Barisan and Perikatan, almost all the candidates in the urban areas are spending very little money because nothing has come down. They're putting all their resources in the rural Malay seats, the one I'm talking about. So that's the reason why there are very limited number of flats, all those things, very limited of free number of free market in the urban areas. So all those things are gone. So basically, my take is that all the political parties are concentrating in the rural areas because they know that is where the big fight is going to be. All the political parties have washed off the urban areas because they think it's going to go red, Pakatan Harapan. So the big unknown is Sabah. Sabah is really the Wild West. Sarawak is locked up by GPS. So we don't have to worry about Sarawak. Sabah, my take is that it will split three ways. And in the rural Malay area in Peninsula Malaysia, my take is that it will only be split two ways, not three ways. And out of the two ways, one will win very big. So we will have definitely a very stable government forming after November 19th. Nobody should get excited. This is actually a very good process for Malaysia. We will have a strong government and we will have political stability from November 20th onwards.
Okay, what a way to end. Thank you very much for joining us. This has been The Economics of Elections. I just had James Chin. Catch you in the next one.